This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network, and we're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. It's time for brunch. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my excellent partner in crime,
Patrick Martin. Thanks for having me, Katie.
Patrick, I really don't have any fun doing this without you. I got to tell you, last week...
You don't have fondue without me?
No, I would never have fondue without you.
Did you just say I'm fond of you?
I'm that too.
Okay.
You are quick today. Must be that coffee you're having.
Yeah.
So we have a fantastic show coming up. Eventually, we'll have Brad Farmery. We'll have Judy Newsom from...
Nancy Newsom, one of the great ham cures.
Queen of cures.
I had never talked to her before, and she called me, and I knew of her because she's Colonel Nancy Newsom, one of the great ham cures. And she called me literally mid-sentence. Like, I'm like, hello, Heritage. And she's like, so these hams just needed to get cured. And you see my previous guy. And she just is like that, you know.
Well, that
they don't make
rock.
Them like that anymore.
Yeah. No, she's going to be awesome. I can't wait to have that on. And Brad Farmery, of course, was the winner of the Cochon 555 in New York City. So he'll be going on to Aspen.
He also has three great restaurants. Double Crown, Public, Colony now, or Colony.
Has that opened?
They ordered something from us.
We're gonna be talking about Colony. And we...
colonoscopy?
No, we're not going to talk about that ever.
Colony. I hope it's pronounced colony, but it's not spelled like colony.
Is it C-O-L-O-N-I-E?
Yeah.
Colony.
Colony.
Oui, c'est comme ça. Alors, and then we should remind people that our sponsor today is Whole Foods Market. And I want to say that Whole Foods Market reminds you that every bite has a story. So whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, you're conscious food choices can change the planet, because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make helps us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. Nice copy. I like that.
Yeah, and we really love it. Now you're going to hear a lot more about our sponsors at the beginning of each show, during the show, at the end of shows now. We're going to start getting, you know, up to minute facts about Barter House, about Whole Foods,
Fantastic.
About Fairway, about
well,
a Hearst.
Whole Foods is going to collaborate with us on a show about their new animal welfare protocols, which they designed partly with Temple Grandin's input. So that should be an interesting little project coming up in the next couple of months.
Very interesting. Animals are the toughest thing to deal with, you know, because they're alive.
Yeah, and they have feelings.
They're
really, really sensitive. Yes, absolutely. And anybody who has not felt that, I just don't understand people who don't think animals are basically humans without verbal skills. Because they're certainly capable of communicating in a variety of other ways, which I can read perfectly well. I mean, I know exactly what my kitty cat is thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And
and your dogs.
Yeah, my dogs, Weston Red. I mean, yeah, animals are sentient beings, you know?
That's right. So we're going to take a quick break.
And then we'll come right back. For these two hands, I'm a working man. Nowhere to go. One last look at the land. Auctioneer with his gavel in hand. And he said, it's got to go. Worked this piece all my life. Broke my heart, then took my wife. Now I've got nothing to show. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man with nowhere to go. Wandered aimless in the city with my dirty work boots and old straw hat in hand. Singing a song by Woody Guthrie. This land is your land. It ain't my land. I'm a working man with nowhere to go.
We're back on The Main Course. This is Heritage Radio Network. Two of my favorite people are right outside the window here. Georgia and Sarah. We are back with our guest, Jeffrey Steingarten.
Oh, we're back already?
Yes, sorry, the distinguished author. I'm going to read a little bit about Jeffrey for people who, if it's possible, don't exactly know why he is so well known or why we are so delighted to have him in the studio.
Isn't it true the S is silent? It's
Eingarten? No, it'd be Tyngarten.
Tyngarten, yeah. All right.
Or would the T be silent and then it would be Steingarten? Yeah, don't mind us, Jeffrey. We're just like...
Tell me as soon as you're finished making fun of my name.
No, I don't think so.
Then I'll go on, and then I'll do... And then I'll say the one word that Patrick said I'm not allowed to say, which is Mangalisa.
Mangalisa, yeah, he said it.
Mangalisa. Let's get it right, guys. It's like nuclear.
No, it's spelled different ways. You can.
M-A-N-G-A-L-I-T-S-A. Mangalitsa. Okay, Mr. Steingarten, in case you haven't been paying attention to the food industry over the last, 25, 30 years, is responsible for all of the food writing in Vogue magazine for lo these many years, as well as, and this is where I got to really, you know, drink your Kool-Aid, is The Man Who Ate Everything.
And yes, what a book.
It must have been something I ate. Two books which entertained me absolutely almost beyond. I mean, really, my stomach is still hurting from laughing as hard as I did over some of the essays, especially The Man Who Ate. The Olestra Incident, I think, was maybe one of the funniest pieces of food writing I've ever read.
What struck you about it?
Well,
Katie?
Let Jeffrey tell. Okay. Oh, yeah, well, Jeffrey, tell us tell us a little bit about the Olestra incident, because that really did leave an impression on me. I mean, I read that book about 5 years ago.
Well, that was actually longer than 5 years ago. I thought that Olestra was one of the great inventions of the 20th century. That was the last century, I think. And but they didn't realize what they had on it. I went to Procter & Gamble's headquarters in Cincinnati. I asked them if I could actually cook with Olestra. No one had been allowed to do that. And I had a whole big long grocery bag, which I had to schlep on the airplane, of chicken for fried chicken and pancakes and everything. And so they let me cook for the morning. Everything came out perfectly fine.
When you say you're cooking with Olestra, what do you you're sprinkling this on,
well,
or in what
you
form
use it
does
as
it
a
come?
Medium? It's like it's an oil.
It's an oil.
The idea was is that it's a non-trans fat, non
in place of olive oil.
In place of any oil is like a calorie-free oil. Am I right there?
Well, actually, Olestra is a method, and you can apply it to almost any edible oil. But what it did was that it passed through your system. Now, some people had.
Like greased lightning, I think is kind of.
Well, some people had symptoms called, maybe it was called anal spotting.
Oh, brother.
I swore we weren't going to talk about it. I mean, we already discussed it. We weren't going to talk
But
about
anyway,
it.
I was explaining to them how.
Anal spotting. That's the first time that's ever been tagged, I'm sure, on the network.
Yeah, Jack is cringing right now.
Two T's.
So I told them that if they apply, I asked them whether they had ever tried the method to kind of defang butter, because that would be a wonderful thing for people's health and everything. And they said, "No, why would we care about butter?" I said, "Don't you understand that that animal fats, saturated fats, are the only kinds of fats that are really bad for you, but also trans fats." They hadn't quite figured that out. I mean, here's this big fucking, this big, big company, and the science, more money than God, scientists, and they didn't agree with me about the saturated fat. So this was really 15 years ago. Anyway, I told them they would get a Nobel Prize if they applied it to butter, and...
at least from the culinary world.
Can you imagine how great it would be if butter just passed through our system? We would be able to swim in it. We'd be able to bathe in it.
Gobs and gobs of it.
We would solidify it.
We'd be able to inhale butter.
Yeah, inhale butter.
Well, the thing that's interesting to me is that it didn't occur to them that animal fats generally tend to be the tastiest fats. I mean, olive oil aside, but really, you know, goose fat, duck fat,
goose fat.
Pork
I cooked
fat,
two geese this
chicken
week.
Fat. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's all over the floors and everything because the garbage bag leaked.
Where did you get them?
Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch, who's a poultry company we work with out in Kansas, they raise about 400 geese a year. So these are African brown geese. And there actually wasn't that much meat on it, but God, if that was a tradition in America, the goose, it would be everybody's favorite meal of the year. Turkey is a solid one, but you know, it's also my, but I mean, the goose.
So the flavor was sensational?
It's all dark meat.
Yeah.
The fat is much more a part of every bite because it's still a lean-ish
bird. Did you use a, with these African brown geese, did you use an African recipe?
No. I tried. But is Tabasco African? Because I just put a little.
A lot of African cultures do use an enormous amount of hot spices.
Now, let me ask you this. Has any American person, food writer, talking about African, it always amazes me, like African art. There'll be like an exhibit at MoMA, African art. I'm like, isn't that an accumulation of many countries, each with their own different
many
art
tribes.
Style? Many tribes. Like, has anyone really broken down the various cuisines of Senegal, Kenya, Morocco, Egypt, Congo? Like, it just seems
I think you're totally misinformed. Africa is one thing. There's no variety when in Africa. Yes, people have broken it down.
But I don't read about that so much, you know?
Maybe you don't read about it because the things you read don't talk about it, but one person you have to pay a lot of attention to is Jessica Harris, who has written very good books. The early ones, or the popular ones, till the last one she published, were about the African-American, mainly the slave influence on American food.
Mm-hmm. Which is not barbecue. Barbecue is not one of them, although it was often thought to be.
No, it is one of them.
Oh, it is one of them.
We think the barbecue came to the southern states of America from African slaves who had been brought to the Caribbean, where many slaves were originally brought because the sugar trade was the largest cause of slavery. And the largest use of slaves, and then they were reimported to the states, to the southern states. I don't think that it's well enough research, but there was a Caribbean word for either Arawak or Taino, a barbacoa, or maybe that's a Spanish translation, and that was cooking over a pit slowly. In any event, that is thought to have been the predecessor of barbecue, and rather than the black people brought it with them to the South. One thing you see in New Orleans, which is not really a southern city, even though it's in the South, because it's so cosmopolitan, but always has been cosmopolitan, is that the only permanent residence over a long period of time were the blacks, especially the black servants, because everyone else changed. First it was the Spanish, then the French, then the English, maybe the French again.
A lot of German Jews, too.
That was a little later, but Creole.
Right around the turn of the 19th century.
Creole cooking was really created by these black cooks, who worked for an ever-changing group of landowners, rulers in New Orleans.
Now, is Creole northern Brazil all the way up to New Orleans, and then Cajun is just one little city in Lafayette? Carlo Petrini said that. He was like, Cajun is a little thing. Creole is just a massive thing. Islands, mainland, everywhere from the mid and the equator up. Is that right?
It all depends. Number one, Carlo is right. To say the Cajun is one small area.
Or I thought it was one small group of people, the Acadians. Doesn't it? Because Cajun come from Acadian, and that was a group of like French Canadian French.
Yeah, like that. Except it was mainly because the English, but after they, they won Canada mm-hmm. by force, they persecuted and expelled. But certainly the Acadians, which were from a part of Canada, they were. The English did a very bad job, and a very mean job of the whole thing. And these people were just sent down to the United States. Now, some stopped in Maine, and others went further.
Huh.
Right.
But then there was this colony of people who went down where they spoke French, and that is New Orleans. But they had no money. One good thing about being in Cajun country was that you could pretty much grow or catch your own food.
Hmm.
So Cajun food is almost entirely made up of things you can either
eat in the wild
or yes.
Now let me. That's fascinating. Cajun is a wild food culture. Interesting.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
No one's ever said that on.
That's
on the
why
show.
The. There are not a whole lot of different spices because spices were very expensive in those days. They had to be brought from India or wherever. And the one local spice was hot peppers. It was, but in that climate, it is so easy to grow hot peppers.
What is the hottest food in the world? The hottest spice, hottest food in the world? Then we'll come back to this. I've always wanted to ask that to someone who would know the answer.
Yeah, I wish I could ask them that.
I mean, there are a few ones. Orange bonnet, wasabi, red pepper. Anyway, sorry, that's
who
a tangent.
Who has the highest Schofield score? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
they measure it in Schofield units, I think.
But not just peppers. A natural, the earth creates the hottest thing. I wonder what takes the
cake.
Well,
I'd like to know what the adaptation of that was. I mean, like,
there is one that has, for a long time, it was the habanero, you call it the Scotch bonnet. The same thing. But there's one that's hotter.
Really?
That I've never had. But one interesting thing that...
What is it? What is hotter?
I just said I don't know what it is.
Oh, you don't know what it is. But there is another one.
Do you want to embarrass me more?
Sorry.
Go ahead, ask me.
I didn't hear.
Hey, Jeff, what's it called?
Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, don't you know that?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was interrupting. So you were saying Cajun is mostly a wild
one really interesting
cuisine.
Thing, by the way, is... that through molecular gastronomy,
mm-hmm.
As the people still insist on calling it.
Not Wiley. He doesn't like that word, nor
no,
Dave Arnold.
None of them actually like it, except for Hervé Tis, who I guess is the one.
None of the people who do it, except for Hervé. And I won't give in to the moment that word was invented, but... 92, 93. Using the rotary evaporator, Wiley doesn't have one, but Dave Arnold, his brother-in-law, does. You can distill from the Scotch bonnet and from every other kind of hot pepper the non-hot parts of it.
Oh, really?
People are always talking about how the real skill with using hot peppers, is not, to make it macho hotter and hotter and hotter, but to play with and be creative with the fruity taste.
Yeah.
It's amazing that anything else could live with that heat,
With like those little tiny bird chilies
to be able,
are very floral and fragrant.
But it's so hard for us, at least, who are not used to eating hot food every day, to distinguish those fruity tastes.
Hmm.
So it would be... I know that Dave Arnold has extracted the...
He does a show on this network, by the way, called Cooking Issues, which airs Tuesdays at noon. It's the best show on the network
in
terms
show.
Of listenership. It is a call-in show.
Call in or write in, yep.
And... but he's not the only one who has, tried to extract the fruity aromas and taste from hot peppers. I'd like to see it done with 10 of them, 15 of them. And I was going to kind of sponsor or help sponsor that, you know, that project for an article in Vogue.
The sweet side of harsh or spice or something like that. I mean,
or just peppers.
Peppers.
It doesn't have to be more global than that. Maybe that'll come in the future. Other people have done that. You know, I mean, have picked one pepper. I can't remember who it was who told me that he did. Did jalapeno. Don't you find it interesting that in India they really have only one pepper?
Which one?
Hot spicy. When I asked Modern Jaffer, he said the red pepper.
He's like, it's the red pepper.
They just call it the red
pepper. The red pepper, what are you talking about?
So Jeffrey? That sounds like it could be many different types of pepper.
It may or may not be. It's, you know, it's the same conundrum of don't you think it's amazing that the French grow, you know, at least 18 different kinds of potatoes?
Yeah.
And they're very specific about which ones you use where. The Italians, who live only a few feet away, down on the map, only a few inches away, have only two potatoes, north and south.
Huh.
Really?
And they eat a lot of potatoes.
They do.
How do you explain that?
That is weird. Well, we're going to cover this and many other interesting issues with one of the literally the most knowledgeable brains in the food world. And I'm going to ask, we're going to ask about that expertise and, you know, culture.
How'd you get there?
Yeah, how do you get to taste 1,000 types of potatoes or habaneros in a lifetime? And what would you warn people against for people who haven't but still write about those issues? So we'll be right back. We're sponsored by Whole Foods, and we've got Jeffrey Steingarten in studio.
He wakes up early in the morning, puts on his only blue suit. He hasn't quite mastered tying his tie on the way his sweet Sarah used to. It's been years since he's talked to the good Lord. He's not sure he even knows how, but he won't be front yard today. He goes to church on Sundays now. No, he don't know the words to the old rugged cross, but he sings them the best that he can, 'cause he knows that his angel is up there in heaven, and he sure never could get him to go. Now he's up bright and early, there by 9:30, and sits on the very front row. And he bows his head with the members, and he shouts amen good and loud. If only church on Sundays now. No, he don't know the words to the old rugged cross, but he sings them the best.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Things mean
he did a drop.
We're doing a sponsor drop right now.
A future show, which is like just a new thing now.
Yeah. We are.
Oh, everyone does it.
We are back. I am Katie Kiefer with my co-host Patrick Martins, and our guest in studio today is the eminent Jeffrey Steingarten. Our show is sponsored by Whole Foods, and now let's get back to the conversation.
So blogging, is that all bullshit?
No.
But I mean, these guys, anyone can get their own friggin' website. I want published material, print publishing, which you do, you know, and did for years, books, articles, like a blog. How can you distinguish who knows what the hell they're talking about?
Let's backpedal for a second, because we were, before the break, we were going to talk about expertise and how Jeffrey became an expert, and that feeds right into...
I thought you were going to talk about why Whole Foods hates me.
Oh, yeah, why?
Well, we can talk about that another time. But no, let's talk about how, because you're saying, why are bloggers allowed to be experts when they're often not? And let's talk about how you get to be an expert, since we have one in the studio. So, Jeffrey, take it away.
I was very fortunate to have a job that allowed me to spend full time doing an article or a little more every month and be able to live on that. To live kind of in Manhattan, the lifestyle. I mean, kind of low level Manhattan lifestyle.
Five 10-bedroom apartment. I've heard.
Well, a very old loft with
a terrace,
kitchen that keeps on kind of growing into the living room. And the library every time I buy a new toy, and. And now the toys, I mean, with molecular gastronomy, the toys are really big. I was just in Madrid, going to Madrid Fusion, which occurs every year. And one thing is, because the Europeans are so vastly ahead of us, you find out about all the new technology. Now they have something which is about the size of a bus. That you need to compress food, or exert pressure on the food equal to 6,000 atmospheres, more pressure than anywhere under the sea on the Earth. And I still haven't figured out whether it would be worthwhile having this bus
in your apartment.
Well, it might be possible to reduce the size. If it were a miracle worker, then they would be able to reduce the size to the size of say, two washing machines stacked.
Now, what is the benefit of doing this?
That's my question. It's like, why do I want to compress my food unless I want it in pellet form?
Or unless I have
to
travel.
In which case, where is gastronomy there?
I've only seen videos of the operation of the machine. It doesn't actually compress it. It doesn't make the food into a tiny pellet. By exerting that amount of force, you kill all viruses and bacteria without
without cooking it?
And without irradiating it.
Yes, without the ill effects of pasteurization.
So it's that, one step past sous vide. It's like, it's raw. It's a raw food movement. No, I mean,
well, yes, but then you might cook it after
cleaning.
That. I mean, you don't have
it's cleaning or pasteurizing the food. So what would you use this on, for instance, meat?
But not pasteurized. Remember, pasteurization is named after Pasteur.
Yeah, you have to boil. It's bringing things up to a high temperature.
And there's no doubt that if you taste raw milk, especially sheep's milk, I remember you're at the Union Square Green Market, which is two blocks from my house and therefore where I shop.
With your dog, Golden Retriever.
Sky, is he still with you?
No, I'm afraid he died.
I would imagine that was, yeah. Sky figured large in a book that was published about 10 years ago.
Died about a month and a half ago. And
oh, I'm so sorry.
What a tragedy.
Not in a way that made me happy with how he died, but we won't go into that.
No.
So, a long time ago at the Green Market, there was a sheep's milk cheesemaker, and then she would often bring the actual sheep's milk, pasteurized and unpasteurized, and you could taste it, and you could see how pasteurization really does give things a cooked taste. There is low-level pasteurization in Canada, for example. I don't think we're allowed to do that here. I'm not sure about that.
Well, tell us about, I mean, this is also, people don't know, one of Jeffrey's many claims to fame is that he was offered the presidency of Slow Food about 10 years before me.
So he could have been your boss.
Then he realized that, then he would have realized that there was fundraising and stuff, so he was like, you know, eh. But, so I want to ask, I mean, talking about these trends, I mean, yes, you're always following these new kitchen devices and technologies, but like in terms of just like trends out in the open world, like this hamburger trend with your great friend Mark Pastore, every time I go to La Frida Meats, pictures of you are littered across the entire facility there, and burgers, butchering meats, like
whole animal
utilization, like, because when you started, it doesn't seem like there was so much attention given to these things, and now all of a sudden there is, and I think you might have been a part of that. So how do you see that whole culture movement unpacking itself?
Well, there are many ways of approaching that. One way, which I can say is my own, you know, sanctimonious take on it all, is that human beings do not need meat in order to thrive, not just survive, but to thrive and be robustly healthy. So the reason we eat meat is for our own pleasure. Therefore, we're taking life for our own pleasure. But somehow we, that includes me, have been able to justify that. And but if you agree with me so far, then you certainly have to agree that there's no excuse for eating any food, for killing any animals in order to eat things that don't give you pleasure. Okay, and if you have like what's the word that I'm looking for? Maybe the shit, like the shit hamburger.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, hamburger, the meat kind of sprinkled on a pizza, or
if it doesn't really have a gastronomic bang
for its
buck,
why? There's just no excuse
for that. Yeah.
No excuse for that.
I would agree with you there.
And there's also no excuse for waste.
What about animal suffering and stuff? Does that play into it? If the animal suffers, I mean,
there's no possible excuse for that.
None. Yeah, you know.
Can you think of any excuse for that?
That's why Heritage Foods exists, is because of that.
Right.
No, there is no excuse. Where I will disagree with you, Jeffrey, is that I do believe that people evolved out of being sort of essentially proto-apes because they were able to cook and eat meat. Because they didn't, I mean, they weren't cultivating any crops. So what else would we, what else explains our evolution? Once we discovered fire and started cooking meat and were able to bring enough protein into the system to grow the brain bigger than a chimpanzee, we were able to digest it better. You must have read Richard Wrangham's book.
Yes, of course. But
Catching Fire.
Yes.
I thought that made a great
argument.
But
equally important, as I have... one of my first articles, I mean, one of my early articles, and it's in my first book, The Man Who Ate Everything, which was a New York Times bestseller.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you. That's NY Times.
Well, neither of you has said that enough.
We didn't say enough about your awards?
So, no, you haven't. But anyway, so I wrote an article which was called Salad the Silent Killer.
Oh, yes, I love
and,
that.
And the idea, which is now fairly widely accepted, although at the time it should have been, and I shouldn't have gotten so much hate mail. most vegetables in their raw state have chemical defenses against people eating them, and especially people eating the people or animals eating the seeds. They get very, very bitter and sometimes even poisonous. So there was an earlier theory, and I think that is you know, as valid as this, but as this meat business, that before the invention of cooking, it was impossible to get very many nutrients at all from vegetables, or from fruit. So
and grains were not cultivated, so that wasn't a big part of the diet. Which, and they have to be cooked anyway, right?
They certainly do have to be cooked. excuse me.
Bless you.
There were anthropological studies showing that about 70-80% of all primitive men and women, cultures, you know, New Guinea, things like that, that they cook between 70-80% of their food. The Chinese, there's one small part of China which I've been told by Nina Simons actually has salads. That's it. The Chinese don't eat raw things. I mean, now obviously they're becoming cosmopolitan. They have sushi bars. They have lettuce. But just think about the Chinese food you had, let's say, at a traditional Chinese restaurant, and as of say 15 years ago, there was nothing raw.
No. Mm-hmm. Except for beef.
Also, it's argued by some people that there's one massive Chinese communal kitchen deep under the city, and well, that's how the food gets there so fast.
There really is no great, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and I know you know better, but I have yet to find a really, truly great Chinese restaurant that has gone that step beyond sort of the communal kitchen style of Chinese.
Well, Grand Sichuan on 55th. And second, it's
really?
Sichuan with the Z, which is supposedly a sign that it's good. And it's a guy who used to write Eric Asimov all these really nice letters each week. And finally, Eric was like, God, just to stop the use of paper, I'm going to go and visit this place. And it turned out really to be one of the best. Very spicy.
Well, Sichuan cooking, I think,
Chengdu.
Is traditionally.
Chengdu
but what do you think, Jeffrey?
Chengdu chicken.
What's your, have you stumbled upon or been solicited by the great Chinese restaurant in New York?
I've had several meals at that 2nd Avenue and the 55th Street, or is it 54th Street?
55th, 56th, I think.
But it's... I'm not exactly sure where Asimov fits into the discovery of that restaurant. if you can give me any dates, then I'll be able to kind of figure it out whether...
real old school, like 2002 or something. No, I mean, I'm sure you were much before, but...
No, I'm not... I ate there with Fuchsia Dunlop. Fuchsia Dunlop is, I think, the greatest expert in the English language. She's British. On Sichuan food, she has the best cookbook, the best Sichuan cookbook of all time, and I wish that I could remember the name. It's possible that it's called The Good Food of Sichuan, which is of course an obvious title. Because of the brick. The play Good Woman of Sichuan, that we're all so familiar with. So I took her to the restaurant on 2nd Avenue and 55th Street to Grand Sichuan. It was the only one of that whole chain that kind of was serious, or you could get them to be serious about actual real Sichuan food.
The menu is like 25 pages long. Has a whole description.
That's usually a red flag for me, but okay.
No, but I'm saying of descriptions, appendixes, written.
Oh, well,
things.
Okay. That's
menu
good.
Menu is like 4 or 5 pages.
But any restaurant that claims that it produces, 50, 60, 80, or 100 dishes or something like that.
Or something that's pan-Asian. Japan, yeah. China. I'm just like, how do you know how to do both?
So you're saying that this, in your opinion, would be the preeminent Chinese restaurant in New York City?
No.
Or Sichuan, then? Or not even that? You wouldn't even give it that.
It's solid.
Solid is good. I would just like to see, Chinese food elevated to the level.
Shun Li Palace.
We sat down and the chef came out. He was very happy to talk to Fuchsia and I was honored. And
I'll bet.
And so then they started talking about the menu for our dinner. I think that I was there with Ed Levine and maybe one other person. And we were just sitting there for 45 minutes while Fuchsia and the chef gabbed and gabbed.
And they hadn't coughed up an appetizer yet?
The Fuchsia was really rude because she didn't translate one word of it. So we were just sitting there. I would have been happy to have gone to a bar and had a few scotches.
Well, you were next to PJ back. Clark's next time that
and,
happened. Well, let's
see,
go.
However, okay, there's a place in London called Bar Shoe, which, in Soho, Soho, London, which, and I would say 50% of the occasions you go there has real Szechuan food that reminds me of the, it's a taste you can't forget once you have it in, for a couple of weeks in Chengdu, capital of Szechuan. And I want to go back there as soon as I can to Chengdu. Now, the travel money is not quite as liberally distributed in the magazine business to these days as it was. It was pretty easy for me to go anywhere. Now I have to have a good reason.
Now you have to have a good reason. Well, you just came back from Madrid. Nancy, we're going to have a 5-minute call-in with Nancy Newsom to talk about ham culture, differences between here and there. But tell us about some of the things you caught in Madrid and some of the things that, struck you besides ham.
Well, ham was certainly one of them. And then all this many of the kind of advanced, innovative procedures of whatever you want to call it, science food, tech food, that Nathan Myhrvold calls it, modernist cuisine. One thing Harold McGee calls it is experimental tech cuisine or experimental cooking.
Is this like Ferran Adrià stuff? I mean, what you were calling molecular gastronomy earlier?
Yes. Most of those techniques, many of those techniques, came from the food industry.
Yes, absolutely. Tom Colicchio told me that. He was like, I spent my whole life trying to get away from industrial food. Why would I want to use those toys in my kitchen now? I thought that was an interesting. This was like, 5-6 years ago when it was just starting to get hot. And I thought, that's an interesting thought because of the circulator and the whole vacuum cooking and all that stuff.
There's
is
a lot
all
of weird
industrial
high-tech preservatives just used in very small amounts.
My sense of, just to be reductive and really annoying about this, is that it's boys with toys. It's like, these are gadgets.
You've just succeeded in being annoying.
This will be the first
girls
of
have
many
no appreciation
times.
For the...
We don't. Girls do not do gadgets.
The warmth and importance... That
of
that,
the circulator?
No, I know of a relationship that only men... mainly men can appreciate between man and machine.
Man and machine.
I think
machine.
That's true. I think you're absolutely right about that, Jeffrey. I mean, I just don't. I don't. I didn't drive a car until I was 40, so that gives you some sense of
you're scared to drive into the city.
I detest
stuff.
Driving. I do it now. I do it, but I really hate it. And I don't even like my computer, in spite of how incredibly convenient and all-encompassingly interesting it has become in my life. But, I don't like any
now,
of
it
those
it occurred
things.
To me the other day when I was kind of writing something about the early days of electric gastronomy. I remember one year, one breakthrough. Ferran
Il Bulli
came up with a dish that he demonstrated at another Madrid Fusion. I don't think I was at the restaurant when the dish was invented. He would come every year and he would show the new discoveries, and all these young Spanish chefs would be able to do everything that Ferran did.
Really.
From the last season, he never gave you the tricks of this season. Mm-hmm. But all these young Spanish and other chefs were just to sit there learning what the state of the art. Not something that happens in this country. And so on a plate, that's kind of part of the decoration, you might say. It was it was kind of vaguely apple themed. there were cubes of like gelatin.
Yes.
You know, dark green gelatin that you know that were you know, tart apple flavored.
Okay.
And then you put them in your mouth and you realize they were hot.
Spicy.
No.
The gelatin was actually hot temperature. Hot in temperature, but it still had a gelatinous quality, which is completely counterintuitive.
No, exactly. And you know, something you've never had. Well, right. I mean, of course, it was done with, you know, either agar or yeah, carrageenan or all the things that I look on.
Those could withstand hot temperatures.
To all the things that I look on the side of a package to avoid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I,
well, but those are natural products. I mean, they never all come from seaweed, well, there was kelp, some paper or whatever.
No, certainly they all come from seaweed and things like that, and they're modified starches, they're called, or hydrocolloids,
otherwise known as meat glue.
No, there's also meat glue too, which is
I thought that was a hydrocolloid. Well, I don't want to get into the, you know, I'm not going to go crazy.
Well,
about
in Madrid,
but
now,
what I'm going to ask? Wait.
Breed doesn't matter, and feed doesn't matter.
Wait.
Something Jeffrey
let's not
said.
Go to. I know he did, but let's before okay. we go to ham because we're going to. I want to go back to this molecular gastronomy business and boys with their
boys
toys.
And toys. You love
and the
that
gadgets.
Jeffrey liked that.
Yeah, this which really is sort of it's like why. Is my sensual, you know, experience enhanced by, is my flavor profile enhanced by the use of these gadgets?
Yes, fruity pepper essence from a hot pepper. That's cool. You never
That's
tasted
cool.
that.
That is cool. No, I do taste that because when I buy Thai bird chilies and I use them in a stir fry or in a soup or something like that, I taste and smell the floral quality of those chilies. Okay, they add some hot spice to it, but they also have like a very distinct
Touché,
aroma
Katie.
And flavor. Okay, so, but I mean, when I'm talking about like, do I care? Why should we care, Jeffrey? I'll play devil's advocate here, as I so often like to do. Why should we care that we had a hot cube of gelatin? Who gives a shit? Sorry.
I care.
But, really?
I go once a year. I like going to
this
WD.
This is what you want to.
Tell me when you're finished your speech, okay? Just tell me when you're finished talking.
You can talk now, Jeffrey.
Okay,
since
I'll
you're
let
our
you
guest.
Go. Yeah, all right. Go ahead.
A lot of things that Ferran Adrià does or did were for fun. He would walk around kind of looking at people but in the restaurant. Being surprised. I mean, he hated people who just sat there, you know, serious the whole meal through. Part of it was delight. Part of it was magic.
Epiphany.
Fair enough.
But, you know, emotions that we don't, you know, kind of associate with haute cuisine. But,
But things that should be associated with haute cuisine.
Excuse me, would you stop
I'm
talking?
Sorry.
Jesus, Katie. Just kidding.
Don't talk anymore, okay, please. Because I have very little time left here, because soon you're going to have someone else.
We hope you stay with Brad, because yes. We're going to be talking about all those funky things that he cooks. Crocodile, alligator, bear,
yeah, we
condor.
Don't want you to go.
Yeah, you can't leave. You showed up late. Now you're being punished. You have to stay the whole time.
No, I am going to stay. But okay, now, there are two basic uses of what we sometimes call molecular gastronomy, you know, and for that matter, there are two basic uses of any innovation in cuisine, and there's a real premium put on innovation these days, you know, on new things.
This is big, listeners. Two things about innovation. What are they, Jeffrey?
One, making traditional food taste better. Taste,
take that, Katie.
Taste and
is
also
is that really innovation?
Katie, don't talk.
Taste and also work better. That's like a Lestra. And two, invent new dishes that no one has ever had before.
Booyah, Katie! Silence.
You know, that reminds me of the art.
Now Heston
business.
Blumenthal at the Fat Duck, his restaurant. Now he has a new restaurant in London, but his kind of main restaurant in the countryside of England in Bray used most of the scientific information that he that both acquired and also developed in his own laboratory to make things better, to perfect things.
Why does everything have to be a traditionalist? Just because you and your friend Erica Demain do Italian traditional?
No, it's not because it has to be traditional. It's because I think that constantly trying to reinvent the wheel without any reference to the past is kind of what went wrong with the art world in the last half century. So it's sort of this. You know, incredible emphasis on creating something new, which is not always necessarily better, and which is often...
So I guess you didn't understand a word I said.
No.
Jesus Christ.
No, I...
Why am I sitting here?
What I did like about what you said was the idea of delight.
Heston uses most of the things, and Heston has a fantastic laboratory in... That built as a little house in the parking lot that he bought near his restaurant after he got rich. He perfects traditional dishes. So, for example, there's a very famous, common pea and ham soup.
Yes.
It's a pub grub, and people have it at at their homes. He has gone to such lengths to create the perfect pea and ham soup, and it is just perfect. He stopped at nowhere. He stopped nowhere. There was no amount of labor and thinking and expense that he did not exert in order to perfect this soup.
Fair.
And so you can call it kind of traditional haute cuisine. Many of the dishes of haute cuisine in France were elevations, whether perfections or not, they can argue, but elevations of traditional and even regional country dishes.
Yes, that is true. That is true. I think what disturbs me is the sort of innovation for the sake of innovation, and that is a trend that really kind of annoys me. But
talking about lack of innovation and doing things in an old school way, we're going to talk 5 minutes while Brad and his right-hand man get settled. We're going to talk with Nancy Newsom from Kentucky about hams. Nancy, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
I didn't know you were there.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the main course.
Yeah, it's really nice
to
have you. So, Nancy, we have a world traveler here. He's the man who ate everything, including all different types of hams. And we wanted to ask you one of the questions as between Jeffrey Steingarten and you is, do you, as a colonel for curing hams down in Kentucky, see there being a difference between, the Spanish and the Italian style or the French style and the kind of American tradition, besides the fact that Americans smoke it? Is there really, what are the differences between the two ham curing cultures?
Well, I would say that among most ham curing processes in the United States, they do not age their hams as long. There are some hams in northern Italy and northern Spain that are smoked, from what I understand. So my hams are smoked also. But I would say that I was thinking about this morning, and I would say that the answer to that is in the aging process and then also in the holding on to as best that Europeans can. They are more traditional in their views on their hams. They're more traditional on their curing practices and holding on to those curing practices. Whereby in America, it appears that for the most part in your commercial ham industry, it is that they are not all about holding on to a family, age-old process as much, because if they were, then there wouldn't be quite as much there would be more aging that went along with it and that kind of thing, which I can honestly say in touting my own product that we are more traditional in that respect.
Tell us a little bit, just briefly for our listeners, because you're going to be coming on again to keep us in the loop with ham curing and what's going on in Kentucky and such, but tell us a brief history of Colonel Newsom's and how long you guys have been around and such.
Oh, okay. Well, as far as the curing experience, we came to America from England in 1642, and the Indians were already curing venison with what they called magic white sand. So we began learning, evidently, from the Indians, because we moved to North Carolina with that process and then moved to Kentucky with it in 1963 when USDA made my father, you know, build a new building. He double-checked the process by an old will. That he was a process he was already using. The as far as our retail experience, we've been in business for 93 years. We've been curing hams commercially since probably 1950, because back in the day before that, everyone cured their own hams. There was no market for it. There was not the logistics that go along with shipping product and everything at that time. So we've been in business 93 years. I've run the business for about 30 years, but my family's been curing hams since the beginning. You know, since they came to America in 1642, which is really funny because their name was spelled N E W S H A M when they came from England.
Newsham.
Newsham.
So I mean, you know, history makes. You know, people make history, but more importantly, history makes people who they are.
Absolutely.
Can I ask what?
Nancy, this is Jeffrey Steingarten.
Hi, this is Jeff. What was it that the Indians were doing to cure
they
hams?
They were curing venison.
Yes, but you had a word for it, white?
Magic white sand.
Magic white sand. I want some of
that. Would
that
be salt?
That was actually sea salt, I feel. And see, that's another thing that is done more so in your European countries, to my knowledge, is that they use sea salt. The salt that I use is not sea salt. And so when I tasted the Spanish hams when I was over there, the difference in mine and theirs, the biggest difference I could tell was that mine had a little more saltiness to them for their age. As opposed to the Spanish.
Could I propose the idea that all salt is sea salt?
All salt is sea salt.
Well, I don't believe that it is. Now, that I'm just now beginning to investigate.
How did it get to the mountains of Kentucky?
The salt?
Yeah, by
the oceans?
The oceans receding.
Yeah, presumably Kentucky was under the sea for thousands of years.
Now, if only your family had been curing for the past 1,000 years, Nancy, you could, through wills and all that, a definitive answer.
Now, also, Nancy, you make very, very famous American Southern hams.
Have you tried it, Jeffrey?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
And what do you think? Where do you try it? At Sambar? Or for your own writings? I mean, like, what's your connection to...
I've bought whole hams in the past.
I was going to say, you probably had a whole taste test.
But also, Dave Arnold had a ham exposition at the New York Hotel and Motel show once, and one was Benton, one was Newsom, and then David Chang has an American ham course.
Section on his menu, which is how
we actually tried that a couple of weeks ago.
It's how we first learned about Sam Edwards, about Al Benton, and about Nancy. And we're really beyond honored that Nancy buys some for the first end of spring, right? Spring sweats or something, or before spring. How are those hams working out for you, Nancy? The Heritage kind.
The hams are working out fine. They're in salt right now, okay?
And I know
they will
came
remain
in cold.
Salt. Yeah,
so you don't brine.
They came from you all. From part of my hams do come from Heritage Foods, and they're the free range antibiotic and growth hormone free, which I do have a market for. And those hams are still in the salt, cure.
Well,
and
that's awesome.
They're stacked one on top of one another.
Well, listen,
and they're packed in salt, Nancy, or you use a brining solution?
Well, no, I don't use the brining. We hand rub these hams for a very long time because we do not use any nitrate.
Right.
If you use nitrate, you can just give them what my father would have called a lick and a promise. And, you know, and just barely rubbed them and gone on. But we don't use any nitrate. So we hand rub this salt into them. Then we sprinkle them with salt, and then we stack them on shelves, and they stay at a certain number of days calculated upon the gross weight of you know, what your average weight of the product was.
Well, that's awesome. Well, listen, Nancy, thank you so much. Are you at your daughter's house now?
Yes, I am. I've been enjoying my grandchildren. Actually, it's a little breezy, but it's kind of warm outside today. I think it's supposed to reach 50 degrees, so I think we're going to go down to the lake.
Are any of your kids
in the lake and go to somewhere reflective?
Any of your kids or grandkids going to continue with Newsom's?
Well, you know, I'm not really. I really seriously doubt my daughter will. She kind of has the same views that Mr. Edwards' daughter has, that the business is hard on us. My son, on the other hand, knows how to cure the hams if something were to happen to me. He's kind of a he is kind of a soulful, nostalgic guy. So, but he also realizes how much, actually, how much of your life you dedicate to this. So it should just be a toss-up as to whether he can stand for Newsom's to not be in existence or not. Like, as in the case was for me when I took it over after a major fire we had in our business.
Well, listen, we hope you stay along forever. Thank you so much, and
thank
I can't
you.
Wait to see you again and then to have you be on again for a little bit of a ham culture.
I'd love to do that. I'm honored.
All right,
y'all,
well,
call me
thanks,
anytime.
Nancy.
I love it.
Okay, great.
Bye.
Now we might as well just cut back in with our talking about unusual things. I cannot wait to ask some questions you
well,
and I
let's
drew
introduce
up.
Our next guests, because I don't see Jack, so I guess... Oh, no. Well, normally we would take a short musical interlude here, but we might as well just keep going because the guys are in the studio. So we have, in addition to our eminent guest, Jeffrey Steingarten, an award-winning writer.
New York Times bestseller, right?
Yes, absolutely. we also have... Yeah, keep spinning it, right? No, we'll do a full rundown. I'll read your biography at the end of the show. We have Brad Farmery of Double Crown and Public, and you have
Colony.
And you have a new restaurant in the works, right?
Actually, Colony is not my restaurant. Oh. It's just a bunch of people that we used to work with and we love very much have gone off and opened a cool place.
Oh, that's fantastic.
In Brooklyn. Yeah, we're really
so
proud
you're consulting
of them.
A little bit with them, or
only going
you're
there
just
to
a
eat
mentor.
And drink. If you call eating and drinking consulting, then
I would call
I'm
that.
All over it.
Yeah, so. Yeah, absolutely. And you've brought a guest with you. Would you like to introduce him?
Yeah, we brought Ryan Butler, who's the pastry chef at Double Crown.
Oh, bravo.
And you know, he's all around good guy, right hand man. A man about town, so you name it, he does it.
Was
so.
He on your Cochon 555 team? Because we should
was.
Mention that you were the winner of the New York chapter of the Cochon 555.
Cooking a red bottle from Lazy Farm.
Thank you very much. We're going to be going to visit Lazy Farm at the end of this month. Did you know that?
I did not.
Would
but
you
I
like
wish,
to come?
I would love it. I would love it.
Really?
It sounds like
February
a pretty...
24th, 5th, 6th, 7th.
Yeah.
It sounds like a cool
it's going to be an absolutely outrageous trip.
Yeah.
So how was the pig? I mean, tell us about the whole Cochon 555 experience, because they sponsor the radio a little bit, and tell us how that went.
The whole experience was amazing. I you know, got asked or invited to do it, and I thought it was pretty cool just to be asked to do it, you know, it being recognized
Brad,
for...
Brad, you are way too modest.
Being recognized for cooking good food and using... pig and doing it right was a nice nod, and so I was looking forward to cooking with all these other great chefs and using great product. And yeah, we had, you know, I think we had an amazing team. We had I say it was kind of probably the most unusual team. We had a Kiwi and Aussie, a pastry chef, and an architect.
Fantastic.
And so that I guess that builds good
oh,
food.
Oh, your brother worked with you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
No, he didn't work with me. He worked against me. He usually gets in the way, doesn't know much about cooking, but he is the master of vibe. So
he is.
You know, kept
he is the
kept
vibe
our
master,
spirits up.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, you did some really funky things, and I want to lead into after this other funky things that you do, just cooking with like exotic foods that a lot of other chefs don't really venture into, but tell us what you did with the pig. I mean, if you give us like a brief rundown of how you used every single part of it.
Well, you know, I think the
how large it was.
Oh, it was a good sized pig. It was about 210 pounds.
Ooh,
so enough to throw your back out if you're not dealing with it right. And you know, but at the same time, it was an amazing pig. It was really firm, a really fat belly on it, big cheeks. And yeah, it was a good looking pig.
Sounds like a Rubensian pig. Fat belly, big cheeks.
Fat belly, big cheeks. You know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, what did you do with the cheeks, for instance? Because there's not that much of to go around. So how do you spread that across a lot of tastings?
Well, that was the hard thing. You know, there's a lot of the primary cuts in such a small amount of what I think are the more interesting bits. And so trying to figure out how you were going to stretch those interesting bits into, 400 tasting portions is tough. So, you know, with the cheeks, for instance, we brined and boiled the whole head, and we did, for lack of a better term, a head cheese, but a pig head terrine, with a bit of five spice and some other goodness in there. With the pig liver, we made pig liver creme caramels, which is sort of a dish I think it started as a joke, and it's turned into one of our best dishes, I think. And, you know, we did a few different blood dishes, and...
Why the fascination with blood? I mean, I'm interested. I mean, more than any other chef, you're the one that's most pounding the drum for the regulation of blood, you know, legalization of it. Because there is a lot of cultural history to that food, but it's prohibited here. So why, what is it about blood, and how do you get it, and what are you trying to do to get more of it?
I'm fascinated with it. I spent about 8 years in London, and you know, black pudding is very common there, and so is boudin noir, more the French style or the morphia, and you know, even over there, I think it's a little bit misunderstood and has a very old fashioned kind of reputation, and maybe that's something that that is not the new wave of food. But at the same time, I think with any ingredient, if you look at it and try to figure out how best to use it and how to turn people on to something that I think naturally turns people away from the plate. I think that's the challenge. I kind of like facing hurdles like that and kind of looking at the chemical makeup of it, the protein structure, and figuring out how can I turn this into something that's not just good but memorable and isn't just okay but is something that people come back for.
Do you prefer the white blood cells or the red blood cells?
I take it all together. Yeah, we
Boudin noir. I mean, it is one of the great French sausages.
Yeah, I think that it can be magical, and I think very eye opening as well. And I think that if you look at a product that, generally speaking, gets wasted, and you're talking from anywhere between 3% and 7% of an animal's live weight is being poured right down the drain, and not only being poured right down the drain, but there's environmental factors that go with this. So then people buy chemicals to neutralize the blood that's going down the drain instead of providing this as a protein source.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, fascinating stuff. So tell us on this kind of thing about bringing new tastes and new cuts, I guess, or, you know, saving parts of animals. I see here grilled kangaroo on a coriander falafel with lemon tahini sauce and green pepper relish. Awesome. And Katie was telling me about a lot of exotic game that you have brought to almost the New York restaurant scene because of time in Australia or New Zealand. So tell us about that, and how the hell do you get those foods?
Yeah, I think when we were first opening Public, we had, we wanted to make a really interesting menu where that was very unlike anything that had happened in New York. I'd never lived or worked in New York, so I didn't even have a very good view of what did happen here and what was happening down the street even. But I figured that there's a lot of people that cook chicken, there's a lot of people that cook steak. And it's not that I don't like those ingredients, but I did want to open people's eyes to new and interesting things like venison and wild boar and kangaroo. I think in the beginning, a lot of people thought it was shock value, and they thought that I was trying to make a big splash in a big city. And I think that eventually ended up that that they came to understand that this is where you can come and find something interesting and find something different. So it sort of evolved over the years, and I think that we have a great crowd that come every day for exactly that. I think at least once a week we have a table walk out once they see the menu, and I'm fine with that because there's a lot of people that are waiting in line to have that Kobe beef tongue or have that kangaroo.
Well, Katie, if you need a mic, share that mic with Brad, because you're the other half of the interview and you have like 20 questions, so you should definitely
I always have 20 questions for Brad. But Brad, I mean, I'm looking at your menus here because I just because Patrick is not, I don't think is as familiar with your cuisine as I am. But I mean, let's talk for just a second about Double Crown, which is, again, spans, half the globe, goes to in quite a different direction than Public. And what was it that that really, a lot of the dishes, even on Public's menu, I know you spent time in Goa. And so I remember you had a fantastic Goan vegetable curry on the menu at Public for a long time. I see that's gone now, but you seem to have like migrated those dishes over into the Double Crown menu. And so what, I think that's a whole new trend that's starting, that people are really starting to embrace, is creating some sort of connection between, American ingredients and more exotic South Asian spices. So let's talk for a second about that, because
I call that a new trend.
No, I probably not a new trend, but certainly a more visible trend.
Would you say that 30 years old would be new or?
Ooh, Jeffrey!
Spicy!
Oh, sound!
Take the mic back.
No. I've already annoyed Jeffrey enough. I he's already told me to be quiet more than once on this radio show, so he can expound. So I'm going to let Jeffrey talk about the genesis of that trend, since he seems so familiar with it, and then you can talk about your role in moving into it.
Hit me, Jeffrey. No. Keep your hands where I can see them.
The importance is how well is it done. There have been lots of attempts to kind of merge Indian spices and cooking methods with the local ingredients. It's a very common thing. But how often has it been done well? I mean, I'm very interested to taste what Brad is doing.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think that that's why the word fusion just makes people's skin crawl. I think that people try to figure out how many things they can get on the plate instead of what the balance is. And I think at least for myself, the way that I like to construct dishes and kind of incorporate new ingredients is to actually go and travel and see how they're used in that spot itself. I try not to dabble with cuisines that I haven't actually been to those countries. I think that that's just a lot of guesswork, but I think actually being there and seeing how local people use it, how they appreciate it, and how they use it to balance flavors within their cuisine, I think that's very eye-opening, and that hopefully allows me to be able to inflect that same balance into what I'm trying to do with those ingredients.
So talking about that in the context of some of the exotic game that you bring in, like kangaroo, how does that manifest itself? Like what do they do there that then informs how you do it here, or alligator or other things that you might do?
I think, I think wild boar, I've done a wild boar hunt, and I've been in certain areas that wild boar is held in fairly high esteem, but again, quite often they're just trying to use the primary cuts. And I had a great kind of eye-opening experience for both sides, where I I'm not a hunter, but I appreciate what they do and the product that comes out of it. And I think I had a great experience where I got to go on a hunt and actually get a wild boar. And then we took all the hunters into the kitchen with us and showed them how they could prepare it in very simple fashion. And it was interesting because they would usually field gut it and leave everything in the field to make it lighter, make it easier to get back. And often they would only take the loins off the back and they would give away the legs, or they would give that to the people that were helping to skin it, or and the head was a definite no-go zone. So we we tried to use every single part and show these people how it could be done. And I think that, I learned something out of it, they learned something out of it, and we all walked away a little bit smarter. And I think that happens any time you can get into a new culture. I think that you can bring something to them and they can bring something to you.
So if you used every part, you would obviously have used pig milk. Is that right?
I have not used pig milk. That I'll admit on right here, right now.
Well, it's a bore. No. Phony.
Sow milk.
I'm out of here.
No milk.
Okay, I have a question though, and maybe Jeffrey knows the answer to this. We have an absolute epidemic of feral pigs in the South and Southwest. And they are a tremendous disservice to farmers all across that part of the country. Why aren't we shooting and eating them? What's the difference?
Brad will tell you the answer.
You mean I stumped you?
It's funny, actually, when I signed up for a hunting license to go after feral swine, mm-hmm. I paid my $10 and there was no limit on how long or how many or anything. It was just kind of like, go for it, you know, do us a favor and help us out.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because I know with almost everything else, there's such a short season and it's very prescribed what you need to do. And this was just like, okay, there you go.
Please kill as many as
yeah.
you can.
Point me in the right direction and get going, you know.
When you went on that boar hunt, which I think I remember described, it was in Esquire, was that where? It was
Journal.
Men's Journal, right. And so it was scary, right? Those boars are no joke. So do you want to talk for a second about like what it was like to sit in the blind and have the dogs flush that boar and what you did next? Who delivered the fatal shot?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the whole setup was a bit ridiculous. You know, I'm as I said, I'm not a hunter, and a lot of it was being organized sort of without my knowledge. And so, you know, I called Uncle Bubsy, who was the man on the scene who was organizing the whole hunt. And I said, you know, oh my God, you know, haven't been down there. I haven't done this before. Do people get hurt doing this? And he's like, oh yeah, all the time. It's not really what you want to hear when you're sitting there in your New York office in your chef whites trying to figure out how this is all going
to
roll out.
I have to be back Monday at 9 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. So. I'm like, I've got a child. Come
and
on.
My wife. Yeah.
But it was, you know, as I keep saying, an eye-opening experience where, you know, we were traipsing through the woods and we were hunting with no guns, just knives and a pack of dogs. And that's the way these guys like to do it. And they like to, you know, try to keep a fair table going. And yeah, it's, you know, they say...
No guns, just knives?
Yeah.
Well, why didn't you go on a different boar hunt? That's ridiculous. And what do you know about killing a boar with a knife?
I agree, but...
If they kill you, these animals.
They're 400 or 500 pounds.
Yeah, and
scary.
And they, you know, down there, they roll in the mud and then they rub against trees, so you can tell how big they are by seeing how high up the mud comes. And so they were estimating that, you know, there were definitely 300-400 pound animals out there. The one that we killed was only about 250, so I guess a medium-sized one.
So let me ask just a technical question. Then we want to get in a little bit to the pastry and how you can make savories, you know, like a pig, you know, help win a competition. But, like, I know how you, like, fish distributors, you know, I've always been taught, like, oh, their stuff's going bad all the time, you know, because it's a fish, so you have to be careful that you're always getting the fish, freshest stuff. You know, with meats, there's many people selling, you know, American meats. But then how do you source, like, exotic game? What's the state of exotic game? Who are its distributors? Does it come fresh? How do you trust the source if it's so far? You know, all those types of questions. Because it's a whole different market in game, I would imagine.
It is. And I think that it's almost the same as any relationship you build with the purveyor. You know, you get to trust the person that you're buying from. And I think that we only buy from people that we trust, but also people that we like. And I think that we try to build a relationship with people who want to see a great product come to us and want to see us do something really interesting with it. Because at the end of the day, that's the best advertising for what they're doing, is right. If we can make something amazing and put it on the plate, then they have a whole lot more people that they can sell to. All of our wild game comes in fresh, with the exception of kangaroo, comes in frozen.
And where do they come? Like via ship, or is there a main guy? I mean, what? How many people use exotic game like that? Would we be surprised? Like, oh my God, a lot of people use it, or really very few people using that?
I think things like venison. You know, it's funny because a lot of people still follow the traditional venison cycle, where they put it on their menu for fall, maybe into early winter when. And it's such a lean meat, and it takes so well to grilling. I think it's a wonderful summer dish. But, you know, it's hard. Unless you're known for that, sometimes it can be a hard sell in the middle of summer to do a grilled venison dish. But we keep it on our menu all year long. And we just in end of year report that we sold about 7,000 portions of venison last year.
Does that make you the number one venison restaurant on the East Coast, maybe?
Well, we use New Zealand venison. It makes us the number one New Zealand venison restaurant in America. So, yeah.
Awesome.
By a long shot.
And now, if we could ask your pastry man here, do you use these same things? I mean, was that a mandate when you did pastry for them to use funky materials in your desserts?
Well, I mean, I pretty much always have used, kind of off-the-wall things mixed with the traditional pastry and kind of, whipping up something new, but using, classic techniques, to not really scare anybody. But
give us some examples.
Dessert wise, we use a lot of miso, a lot of bacon fat. With the cochon, we had an opportunity to do a lot of, a couple of desserts and a couple of cocktails. Mm-hmm.
A cocktail featuring bacon.
Right. Actually, smoked pork fat.
Bacon ice cream, I think, is great. Right. But
a lot of like pork, trends go really well with desserts. Think of breakfast,
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that because earlier in the discussion, when I was, still permitted to speak, Jeffrey and I were discussing the fact that, in fact, this is what instilled him to admonish me, was using recreating the like new for the sake of new, but building from old techniques. And I think that's a little bit of the theme throughout this discussion. Mm-hmm. And so we were talking about molecular gastronomy, even though nobody likes that term. But so how much of what you're doing do you think is just kind of like, wow, let me just play with this and see what happens, and maybe I can invent something incredible and new that nobody's ever seen before? Or and how much of it is really based on like, well, I know that this is a solid set of flavors and and here's my flan to put it in or something like that?
I mean, the way that I, look at it and try to develop dishes is more, let's try it. Why not? I mean, what's the difference? If it doesn't work, we'll do something else. I've made many, many things that were terrible, and then we just scrap it and start again and then look at it in a different way. I've been trying to do this toasted rye bread ice cream for years, and I just never liked it.
That
sounds
very good.
I know, it does.
Very good.
Because I really, really like another thing we like to use in the pastry department is caraway seeds, because I think they're very interesting. They work really well.
And you find them later in your teeth. I love that.
Well, we grind them up into a powder, but
I'll make you some
special caraway seeds. I mean, it does have a kind of that feeling of rye bread and something, you grew up with, like growing up, I ate a lot of that in sandwiches and things. And I thought, why not,
There was that scene in City Slickers where supposedly, I guess, the Ben and Jerry look alike, and they say, name me any main course, an appetizer, and we will tell you
we can match the perfect ice cream with it. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. Toasted rye bread ice cream, I know right now, would be delicious.
Well, to go back to what we were talking about with Ferran Adrià, wasn't it Ferran Adrià who came up with Parmesan ice cream, or he had the Napoleon of... That was like an interstitial, what do you call that when they, we have the granité or something like that in between courses. Intermezzo, yeah. Right. I mean, actually, have you ever thought about doing that? Like doing a sort of savory sweet for in between your courses, Brad?
Thanks for opening that can of worms. The L train ride back is going to be a pain in the ass for Brad now. He's like, the people are demanding it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 10, yes. Next question.
No, but I'm sorry, Jeffrey.
Can I ask something about your pig?
Hit me.
How did you cook the pig?
For cochon or the wild boar?
That was the cochon. I'm sorry.
Oh, for cochon, we looked at doing probably too many dishes. We did about I think 10 different dishes. Wow. To try to make sure that we could use all of it. We smoked the pork bones and made a laksa, a Southeast Asian soup. We took the... I wanted to make lardo out of the fat, but I didn't know if it was a lardo crowd, so we smoked the fat, and that's when we did the fat-washed cocktail sort of what Eben Freeman started doing 4 or 5 years ago. We, you know, and Eben was nice enough to come and visit us and talk about how he came up with that dish or that cocktail, and told us, you know, gave us a few hints. So again, we were
where were you able to find a non Lardo crowd?
New Jersey.
That's a good question. I think it's, well, to be honest, I think maybe more than anything, I thought it was something that someone else would do. I thought that everyone's going to have a lot of back fat, and what are they going to do with it? So yeah, we wanted to go a slightly different direction. We did the pig liver creme caramels. We made pig blood popsicles, which went over a treat. We did black pudding pie. So we basically did a lot of grinding of the heart, the kidneys.
What did you do with the loins and stuff?
You know what, man?
You threw those out.
That's the funny thing. We were like, what are we going to do with those?
How do you make that interesting?
But you know, we that actually...
That's
most
the worst part of the pig, anyway.
Yeah, I think so, too.
It was expensive, but
yeah,
useless.
Yeah, it's funny, and people would probably have a heart attack, but we ground a lot of it up and put it in with our black pudding. So we kind of stretched the blood that we had and the back fat that we had with the premium bits.
It's interesting. Like, if you actually think about it, based off what you just said, Jeffrey, it's really the cheapest, the quote-unquote least desirable parts of, for instance, the pig should actually be the most expensive, because A, the littlest amount goes the furthest way. And I mean, you know, like pig head terrine, for instance, you sell a little, or ham. I mean, God, we sell ham for $2 a pound, and then someone will then, you know, $24 a pound or something like that, you know, sell for it. Obviously, it has to cure for a long time. But, well, one of these questions I wanted to ask you, especially, I mean, your mentors. Because we only have a couple minutes left, but I mean, who were some of your mentors to do some of this really funky, bring cuisine like this to New York?
Again, all of my real cooking has been done in the UK and London. One of my big mentors was a chef named Peter Gordon. He was a New Zealand chef, but he was well known for kind of bringing spices from all of his travels into his cooking. But he was also a big fan of trying to make the secondary cuts the center of the plate and the real hero. You know, he was actually Fergus Henderson's head chef at the French House.
When
Fergus first started serving food, Peter was the man behind the stoves. And so, you know, I think the combination of both their ideas turned into something really amazing, you know, with what Fergus is doing now. You know, I worked at a lot of restaurants and Michelin star restaurants, and I thought it was really interesting how they could get people to not just eat head and kidneys and pig blood, but get them to pay a lot of money for it. So I think that in England, I think that rationing and a lot of the World War II stuff, like, you know, Victory Gardens and rationing and making the most out of a small amount, is still kind of playing its way out onto the plates even after all these years, and not just in cafes and restaurants, but Michelin star restaurants.
Carlo Petrino, he said famine is the driving force of all gastronomy. You know, it all comes from a place of rationing, or, you know, just famine in general.
Yeah.
Which you and Jeffrey were alive during.
Yes, we were.
A lot of that.
That's right, weren't we, Jeff? One thing I wanted to say, though, about...
That's a ridiculous thing, Chris. Most gastronomy in the past has come from the royal courts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly what L'Escoffier and all of the great French, I mean...
that's interesting.
I mean, yeah, well, because who could afford to pay somebody to cook and get all those fantastic ingredients? And spices were very expensive, as we've discussed earlier, so that does make sense. But I think
I ask Brad?
Yeah.
One thing about the pig. One time when I was in Thailand, I was in Chiang Mai, which is in the north, and someone who had read The Man Who Ate Everything wanted to show me that I would be squeamish if he, but you know, if he fed me certain things. So we went to a Chinese restaurant which I had a specialty of chicken brains. I was looking forward to that. I didn't know they had brains, and in any event, they're very small.
Very small.
If you take them out, you probably get these kind of little yellow nuggets. They must be,
I'd say, half a teaspoon. Yeah.
But they were out of season.
So, they were.
So instead we had pig's brains in a kind of gratin. And naturally, I was a little reluctant, you know, to take the first bite. It was so delicious that for some reason I did not find out how they made it. Well, one reason was that I was told that there'd be a lot of Chinese gangsters there, and it would be better if I just kept in my seat.
Ate your food and kept your questions to yourself.
Pig's brains. Now that's not.
Well, I would love to know, and they were just delicious. And apparently, farmers and American farmers, but in the old days, did not throw out pig's brains.
Did you? Have you come across it at all?
The only way I've ever had pig's brains was mixed with scrambled eggs, and I even had it once with some shaved truffle over. So it's taking, you know, one of the most humble ingredients and bringing it really right up there. And
that sounds great.
And I agree. It's a very subtle texture. It's a very subtle flavor. And I think something like eggs are a great way to sort of stretch it out into a meaningful dish. And then you throw truffles on it, and it's extremely meaningful.
Mike, in the South, or I don't know, maybe it was ubiquitous in the United States, but my grandfather used to, before they put a ban on beef offal, or at least on beef brain, he would frequently serve up calf's brains and scrambled eggs. I've never heard of pig brain before, but calf's brain, I think, was very common. And my grandfather was from New Orleans, as was my dad, and it was a real favorite for them, along with eel, for some reason, was another big breakfast dish for them. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, to go back for just a second, and then I know we have to wrap up pretty soon, but Jack is like, uh-huh,
Jack's
yeah.
Jack's like, I got my next
enough,
show.
You freaking blabbermouth.
They have someone better coming on after us?
Well, no, there's our next
actually,
show
yes.
Cutting the Curd.
It's Anne Saxelby.
Cutting the Curd.
Saxelby
it's about
Cheesemongers.
I wanted her to call it Curds Way, but instead she called it Cutting the
she
Curd.
She called it Cutting the Curd, and she did the right thing, Patrick, really.
She did the right thing.
Yeah, because not everybody's going to get the inflection exactly right like you do.
You need the hand motion.
Yeah, you do. But to go, for one second to go back to that idea of what is gastronomy and like where, you know, Jeffrey, you're saying that it really came out of aristocratic family homes and royal courts.
He's talking about the funky new stuff. I guess Carla was talking about like potatoes or something.
But the thing is that what Brad said was interesting to me because yes, all of a sudden things like beef cheeks or pork cheeks, pork nuggets, I mean all these bits that were traditionally associated with cucina povera mm-hmm. have now become the haute cuisine, and that I think is sort of the
high low interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that I think is what is an interesting development. I mean
maybe that was done by the French during the Nouvelle Cuisine period. I remember eating at one of the first three-star meals I ever had. I'm sorry, I'm about to sneeze. So
okay, let's say them. We can know La Grenouille, La Bernadette.
La Grenouille, La Caravelle.
We'll talk about La Pyramide. You went to Maison La Pyramide?
Well, this was actually Alain Chapelle, and he had two of the rustic dishes he had brought back brought to his fabulous, refined restaurant were the deep fried calves ears and poulet en vessie, which is now popular again. That is the chicken, steamed in a pig's bladder.
Ooh, yeah, everyone wants bladder. Mario Batali was always like, first question and last. I want pig bladder. I want pig bladder. I want pig bladder. And we could never, you know.
But that was 1978, I think. And he was one of the greatest chefs who ever lived. And in those days, three-star, the French restaurants meant something.
It doesn't anymore?
Can of worms.
Yeah, that's another program.
Yeah. How much time do you
going
have?
The wrong way.
That's not a wrap-up question, is it, Patrick?
Yeah. No, but I mean,
is this a cliffhanger? Do we continue this
well,
next week?
We actually do want both you guys back for yeah. sure. I mean, Jeffrey, we could have. There were maybe five, but basically, I like about Jeffrey, you can literally say a word.
Two pages of questions for you.
Two
that we didn't even.
I'm sorry,
cover.
Katie. Was I being a bad co-host today?
No. I was a bad co-host. I had to be reprimanded by our guest,
Jeffrey.
You know that's bad. So I guess we should wrap it up, though, right, Jackie? Is Jackie giving me the thumbs up? He is. So
I don't think that was a thumb.
That was not his middle finger, I swear to God. He did not flip me the bird. But I do want to thank Brad and Ryan for coming in from Public Double Crown. You're at Public?
I'm at Double Crown.
You're at Double Crown. And nice. I urge people to check out both of
these
restaurants.
Always an Australian in the kitchen.
Absolutely
there.
Fantastic.
Someone from England. Every time I call the kitchen, I'm like, hello.
Two great restaurants. And, of course, the eminent and fantastic, amazing and incomparable, irreplaceable Jeffrey Steingarten.
You need, I mean, I know we are way past, you know, you're way above us, but would you way. Consider doing a show? You should have your own show. And you come in once a month and they give you a
but only
pizza.
If I get to heckle him.
You should really come and do your own show.
I love being heckled, buddy.
Josh Ozersky was, you know, I know he's your friend. He used to have a show on here, and he's gone. We need a real, true force. We need to graduate now to a great mind and do a and
why
do your
Josh
show.
Josh have a show anymore?
We
he's
have to
too
cancel
busy.
Him. We had to cancel him. Yeah, it was, he wasn't working out. No, I don't know. I think he was too busy.
He's
but,
too busy.
We do, would like you to come and do a show.
Well, we can talk about that.
Okay, good.
Well, we want to thank our sponsor for today, which was Whole Foods Market. As always, they've done a great job.
We have Temple Grandin coming
on in a
couple
weeks. She's coming
on
in March, March 27th.
March
27th, stay tuned for that.
March.
We have many great shows between now and then. And we'll be back next week.
Thanks, Jack.
For another great show. We have Deborah Krasner, Good Meat, next week, and a few other fantastic guests.
Yeah.
So do stay tuned for that. And thank you, Jack, for all your engineering and production. And thank
prowess.
You again to our guests for joining us, including Nancy Newsom on the phone today. So see you next week, folks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.